and saved the company in 1984. With the help of Stanley Gold, Roy's partner and friend, from the outside, and Ray Watson, the chairman of the company, from the inside. Roy, Eisner insisted, deserved the lion's share of credit for the astounding success of animation. The common wisdom was that drawing a movie frame was archaic and too expensive, but Roy bought none of that. Which shows how insightful and downright gutsy Roy was to insist way back in 1984 that we pour major resources into what most people thought was a moribund, money-losing enterprise that would only be relegated to kids' matinees. Roy understood that animation done right was magic, and magic is the essence of Disney. Katzenberg warranted only fleeting mention. One of his major responsibilities was to work with Roy to restore Disney's lost luster in animation. "We should always remember that we have Roy to thank," Eisner concluded. 5. One afternoon in late 1991, Eisner called Steve Burke, the young head of the Disney stores. "I'm going to St. Louis. Come along and we'll visit some stores." Once on the Disney plane, Eisner asked Burke what he'd like to do next. "I'm really happy doing the stores," Burke said, but Eisner persisted. "After the Disney stores, what do you want to do?" "Gosh," Burke said, "my dream job would be to run a theme park." Eisner grabbed the phone and called Wells. "He said theme parks," Eisner said. "I told you he'd say theme parks." Eisner hung up and turned to Burke. "We want you to run Disneyland." Burke was thrilled. He started haunting the park with his wife and kids, developing ideas. But months passed, and nothing happened. Finally, Wells called to tell him that Dick Nunes had been cool to the idea of naming someone from outside the parks division with no theme park experience. Instead, they wanted him to help run Euro Disney, which was scheduled to open in April 1992, working closely with the French resort's new head, Philippe Bourguignon. Burke didn't really want to move his family to France, but he agreed. Wells promised to bring him back to the United States in a few years. When Burke met with Bourguignon, he said, "Steve, we are about to lose $500 million. Burke was stunned. Neither Eisner nor Wells had given him any hint. He couldn't believe it. "Let me look at the numbers over the weekend," he said. By Monday morning, he conceded, "You're right." The cost of building Euro Disney had soared, and even though Eisner always insisted the project was within its budget, that was only because the budget was constantly revised upward. By his own reckoning, Eisner had attended over 50 meetings with the Imagineers and pored over the design of every aspect of the new park, starting with the Magic Kingdom's centerpiece castle. In both Disneyland and Disney World, the castles had been made of molded fiberglass. Tony Baxter, an Imagineer who'd bonded with Eisner after designing the captivating, albeit expensive, Splash Mountain attraction, pointed out that in France, Disney could hardly use fiberglass when the countryside already boasted real castles made of stone. "We can't just do a kitschy rendition of French history right in their own backyard," he argued, and Eisner had agreed. Instead of using the kind of actual European castles that had inspired the ones in the American theme parks, the Imagineers turned to the fantasy castles in Disney's animated classics, especially the